So again, welcome back to lesson four and part two, and we're going to continue our study of Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 through 25. I'm going to take a look at two more aspects of these verses that I want to concentrate on. So again, in the first one, we talked about that this is God's inspired word, and a great example is in verse 11, where it talks about the fact that we do not know Moses' age. The Bible doesn't say that here in the Torah. However, in rabbinic tradition, in the Midrash of the rabbis, they say he was 40. Then some rabbis say he was 20. There's a disagreement between them. In Acts chapter 7, we find out that Stephen, right before he's martyred, says that Moses was around 40. So I suggest to you that more than likely, it seems like Stephen was probably stating his agreement with the rabbis at that time and with Jewish thought at that time that Moses was perhaps around 40. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But indeed, was Moses 40? We don't know. It could very well be that, and I developed that case, that if this is rabbinic opinion, there's nothing wrong with their opinion and their view. With regards to the Bible, there's nothing to base that when we actually study the Bible, especially when we go into the Torah. The second aspect that we took a look at was, is there a case to be made that Moses did not intentionally kill the Egyptian? Yes, there is. And we took a look at the word nacha, and what the Egyptian was doing to the Hebrew slave in verses 11 and 12. So Moses did to the Egyptian. And because of the choice of the word nacha, we see that it's very likely that Moses did not intentionally kill him. Maybe it was more like second-degree murder and an act of passion. But again, the Torah is silent there, but the case can be made that Moses did not intentionally kill the Egyptian. So let's get to the third. So when you're reading these verses, it's found out that Moses killed the Egyptian. We studied a little bit, or I mentioned what the Hebrew meaning is, where Pharaoh is searching him out to kill him. No, Pharaoh was searching him out. They were looking for him with police so that he'd have to be executed. And Moses flees to Midian. He marries the daughter of Reuel. And his wife's name is Zipporah, means little bird. Has a son called Gershom, means foreigner. Now, Moses' father-in-law is Reuel, clearly, because it says Reuel is the father of Zipporah and her sisters, her six sisters. But then, wait a minute. What about Exodus 3:1, when it says Moses was pasturing the flock of his father-in-law Jethro? Wait a minute. Did Reuel change his name? Or does Reuel, the father of Zipporah, the father-in-law of Moses, does he have two names? What's going on? On top of that, we can go to Numbers 10:29, and Moses is talking to a guy by the name of Hovah. Now, your Bible probably will say Hobab or Hobav. Actually, in the Hebrew, it's pronounced Hovav. And Moses is talking to Hovav in Numbers 10:29, and it says Hovav is the son of Reuel, Moses' father-in-law. Now, this is interesting in the Hebrew, because with regards to the Hebrew, there is no punctuation. There are no commas, no semicolons. So it could be that Reuel is the father-in-law of Moses, which we say yes, or it could mean that Hovav is the father-in-law based upon Hebrew grammar. It could be one or the other. But then on top of that, you take it even further. You go to Judges 4, verse 11, and Hovav is definitely called the father-in-law of Moses. Now, this will drive you crazy. Reuel is the father-in-law? Wait a minute. Well, it seems clear. But what about Jethro and now Hovav? What seems typical in our experience as we Christians and even Jewish rabbinical scholars, they force a solution. So I'm going to give you a forced solution from Dr. John Caried in his commentary on the Torah in the volume on the Exodus. So Dr. John Caried forces a solution. He says, the father's name is Reuel. That's exactly what it says, obviously, in our verses in Exodus chapter 2. Which perhaps means friend of God or shepherd of God. Elsewhere, he is called Jethro. In English, not in Hebrew. And that's Exodus 3:1, Exodus 4:18, and so on. The latter name, Jethro, derives from a stem meaning abundance or superiority. Why is he given two names? Some argue that they refer to two different people, although that is difficult to support textually. Yes, it is difficult to support textually in English. Now we're going to go to the Hebrew. The answer is simple. And that's a forced solution. Now, what's the Hebrew word used for Reuel, for Jethro, and Hovah? The Hebrew word is katan. Again, the Strong's number is H2859. And when we actually go into the Gesenius, it talks about a father-in-law, a son-in-law, or a connection by marriage. It's not used as much in that connection. Or joined by affinity. Joined by affinity means that if somebody is your katan, you are joined by affinity, which means there's a relationship between a spouse and the blood relatives of the other spouse. So now we have a conceptual idea of this Hebrew word katan, in the sense that the spouse has a relationship with the blood relatives of the other spouse, the blood relatives. Now, when we go into the InterVarsity Press Bible Background Commentary of the Old Testament, which I highly recommend, as I do highly recommend Dr. John Caried's commentary as well, they get into the Hebrew. And in their commentary, especially on Numbers 10, verse 29, where it says, Hovav, the son of Reuel, quoting from the InterVarsity Press Bible Background Commentary, in Exodus 2, Moses' father-in-law was called Reuel. In Exodus 3, he is referred to Jethro. And here, he appears to be named Hovav, and when we take, like we just did, Numbers 10:29, and then we took it to Judges 4:11. It seems Hovav also is called the father-in-law. The difficulty can be resolved once the ambiguity of the terminology is recognized. The term designated male in-laws is non-specific. Katan, referring to a male near relative of the bride, the term could be used for her father, brother, or even grandfather. Most solutions take account of this. Perhaps Reuel is the grandfather head of the clan. Perhaps Jethro is the father of Zipporah, and technically the father-in-law of Moses, and Hovav is the brother-in-law of Moses, Jethro's son. Alternatively, Jethro and Hovav could both be brothers-in-law, and Reuel the father. So when we take a look at the Hebrew, and we take a look at what the Hebrew word actually means, it clears it up. We've got to take the Bible again and put it into its Hebraic textual context and understand that indeed Hebrew words do not have definitions. English has definitions. They're very precise and very limited. But when we get to Hebrew, they're conceptual. The conceptual idea of Chatan is I'm a spouse and I'm related in some way to the blood relatives of the person I am married to. Blood relatives. The blood relatives by marriage are going to be a father, a mother, a grandfather, a brother, a sister, etc. So indeed, this is a third aspect that clears it up. Now, we'll come back to that all along, and I'll be mentioning this lesson, lesson four, part two, about Reuel and Jethro and Kovav. Now, there's a fourth aspect, and this is the fourth aspect that I really want to concentrate on. We get down to verses 23 through 25. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died. And the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. So Israel cries out. The Hebrew word is za'acha, and the Strong's number is H2199. This is a shrieking. This is a cry in desperation. A crying out of great pain. Ray Vanderland, my first teacher in the concept of the historical context or studying the Bible in its historical context, he has a series of DVDs where he teaches on site, whether it's in Israel or in Jordan or in Turkey or Greece, Rome, Sinai, Egypt. And he has one DVD that's called God Heard Their Cry. And I highly recommend the entire series. But when you do get the DVD, the key thing that you should get is the discovery guide that goes along with each DVD. And that's what I'm quoting from. So God heard their cry. This is about the Hebrews in Egypt and about the good news of the gospel that's in the Torah. But Ray makes this point in here, and everything here is documented with some great resources. So in the discovery guide for that DVD, the Hebrew word ze'aka is translated as cry out in English. This strong word implies a desperate outcry made in response to great pain that is usually caused by oppression. God responds with power when he hears such a cry. The Jewish understanding of Exodus 2, verse 23, remember now it says the Jewish understanding of Exodus 2, verse 23, is that although the Hebrews cried out during their years in bondage to Egypt, they cried out to no one. And when we really take a look at the translation of this Hebrew, they cried out to no one. Go to Exodus 14:10. Za'akah is used again. Oh no, I'm sorry. They cried out, but it's not za'acha. It's a different Hebrew word, but they cried out. And in Exodus 14:10, if you remember, they're trapped at the sea. And Pharaoh's army and his chariots are right there separated from the Hebrews by God, the cloud of fire. And they cry out, but it says they cried out to the Lord. The word Lord there in Hebrew is Adonai, which is a cover word because in the original Hebrew, it's Yahweh, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, God's actual name. They cried out to not just God, they cried out to his name, Yahweh. That's far different than what we're reading here where they just cried out. So they cried out, but God did hear them, even though their intention was not to cry out to God. But of course, this is part of his plan. He knew he was going to fulfill his promises and his covenant that he made to Abraham, then to Isaac, and then to Jacob. These are the descendants of Abraham. And we can go all the way back to Genesis chapter 12, where God promises Abraham indeed a land. He promised Abraham a people, very numerous. He promised Abraham a position, and he promised Abraham that he would be a blessing to all nations. So, I want to consider some verses here in light of the fact that in Exodus chapter 2, verse 23, Israel cries out in bondage to no one. Let's take a look at some verses. Exodus chapter 1, verse 7, the land was filled with them. This is before slavery. Now we'll recall back in lesson 1 of this series on Exodus, Joseph dies at 110. Now you can read this in Genesis 50, 25 through 26. And the date of his death was 1806 BC, which is 280 years before Moses' birth. So let me say that again. Joseph dies as 110 in the year 1806 BC, 280 years before Moses' birth. This all depends upon the date of 1446 BC as the date of the Exodus. Now we are going to deal with this in the next two lessons, the dating of the Exodus and biblical dating in general. I think you're going to be blown away. We're going to do this in two lessons, not just one, because we need to establish definitely that the Exodus is an event that happened here in the 15th century BC. But at any rate, Joseph dies at 110. It seems as if, as we learned in lesson one, that there's no slavery for a number of years until Amoses I in 1549 BC, 23 years before Moses' birth. He is the one that comes to power. He's an Egyptian. He defeats the Hyksos, which were Semite invaders of Egypt. The Hebrews had it good. They probably had it good for over 200 years. And it's very likely, as Ray Vanderland would say on his DVDs related to Egypt, that they bought into the wrong story. They bought into the worldview of Egypt. It's possible that they were living in Goshen, which they were. And because of Joseph's relationship to the Pharaoh, and he's the hero of saving Egypt, even today, the Muslim Egyptians consider Joseph a hero that saved Egypt. You can actually study that even today. It's likely that the Hebrews then were invited by other pharaohs as time passes to join in other work, in other careers, in other crafts, and so on, as they moved out of Goshen into the area of Memphis, large city, and even down maybe into the area of Luxor, going down into Lower Egypt and being part of the community. We're going to take a look at that later in terms of the fact that is it likely that the Hebrews actually moved and became part more of Egyptian culture that way? Yeah, and we'll do that. In Genesis 47, verse 27, we read the following, and I really want to bring this verse up. 47:27. Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt in Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. So indeed, definitely before Joseph dies, the sons of Jacob, they're fruitful and they multiplied, and so they were having a lot of kids and they acquired land. Now, this gets really fascinating. They acquired property. The Hebrew there is achaz. And again, the Strong's number is H270. And the conceptual meaning is to take hold of or to seize. It has the implication of becoming part of something or to join something. Not just acquired property, you know, seizing property or seizing land, but it has the general idea of becoming part of something, adhering to something. When we actually take a look at rabbinical commentary on this verse, I'm going to go to the Chumash, which is Orthodox biblical commentary. Like I said, I in many times disagree with rabbinical midrash, especially when they make the Bible say something that it doesn't say. However, these are scholars, and many times their views are very important for us to understand. Let me read this in their comment about Genesis 47, verse 27. They acquired property. So here's their midrash. They're not content with the land that Joseph had given them. They bought more and more land. That's one rabbi by the name of Ibn Ezra. That's his view. That's his midrash. An indication that they were no longer regarding themselves as aliens who were sojourning in Egypt, but as permanent residents. And that was another rabbi by the name of Keli Achar. The Midrash renders that they were grasped by the land of Egypt, and implying they could not leave. So the Bible doesn't say that. However, the rabbi's opinion seems to make sense in light of the culture. They were grasped by Egypt. This is a spectacular land. When you actually go to Egypt and you visit these places, ancient Memphis, Giza, the pyramids, ancient Alexandria, Goshen, Luxor, all up and down the Nile and all the temples, it is just an amazing, amazing culture, an amazing empire. So implying that they could not leave, to make sure that they would remain there as long as necessary to fulfill the prophecy made to Abraham about persecution and enslavement. But here's the statement that the rabbis make that I think is something we really need to grasp to understand what's going on in Genesis 47:27. This has the further implication that Israel slowly became grasped by Egyptian culture, grasped by Egyptian culture. They joined, they adhered, they were taken hold of, seized by the Egyptian culture in a sense that they had begun to slide into assimilation. The Hebrews assimilated into the Egyptian culture. No wonder Moses the First, first Pharaoh of the 18th dynasty, and the 18th dynasty is when the Exodus happens, he puts them into slavery. They're Semites. The Hyksos were Semites. And we remember the Pharaoh actually talking about this in Exodus chapter 1. Hey, they might be have relationship with our enemies, the Hyksos. And we've got these Semites living among us. They're all over the place. The land was filled with them. So it could very well be that the Pharaoh gathered them up all the way from Luxor to Memphis and brought them into the area of Avaris in the Goshen area and put them in the slave camps. Now we go to Joshua 24. And I really believe Joshua 24 is one of those verses that really cements the idea of what the rabbis were talking about in the Chumash, that the Hebrews assimilated into the pagan culture. So in Joshua 24, verses 14 through 15, Joshua says, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord." Joshua is saying, this is just a few years after they left. Joshua was with them. He was with them when they rebelled and did not want to go into the land. And he's saying, your father served the gods of Egypt. Verse 15, if it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your father served, which is the gods in Egypt, or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I want you to notice the phrase both in verse 14 and in verse 15 about the river. Okay, your father served the gods beyond the river. And then later on, serving the gods beyond the river. The river is the river of Egypt. This was the separation between what you would call the promised land. This is in those days now. Okay, you're dealing with 3,400 years ago. But this was the separation. Today it's called Wadi Al-Arish. And you can actually look it up and actually see. It's about halfway between, if you find the Gaza Strip and you find Egypt, you'll find El-Arish. There's a city there, town down there now. Was about roughly about halfway in between. But the key here is the father served the gods of Egypt. What's our conclusion? Most Hebrews bought into the wrong story. Most of the Hebrews bought into the worldview of Egypt. Because we go back to verse 23, Za'acha. They cried out to no one. They didn't know the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now remember I said, the majority, it seems as if Moses' family still held on to their relationship with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They had assimilated into the culture. And one of the questions we have to ask is, how is God going to get them out? We'll deal with that later on in our Exodus study. How is God going to get them out? It's always an interesting phrase when you said, or when we say, it's one thing to get the Hebrews out of Egypt, but it's another thing to get the Egypt out of the Hebrews, that ingrained worldview that they had. And for us today, it seems as if that many in the church have bought into the wrong story. They've embraced the secular and liberal culture that's around us. And just like in Egypt, where they were grasped, seized by the Egyptian culture in those days, so too many of us Christians are grasped, seized by the Western culture around us, in riches and prosperity, comfort and pleasure. One has to ask, why didn't the Hebrews leave Egypt? Right from the get-go. I mean, if you recall, Jacob dies. Joseph promises his dad that he would bury him, in the cave of Machpelah near Hebron, with his dad Isaac and his grandfather Abraham. Joseph returns, he dies a little bit later, but the Hebrews never left. Why didn't they leave? They would have known. Now the question is, would you? Why return to Canaan? Why return to a land? You really have to do a lot of work to live as compared to Egypt. And for us in the church, how have we assimilated into the surrounding culture? It seems as if that you can't even tell a Christian from a non-Christian these days. And perhaps, just like the Hebrews, that there's a remnant of his true disciples. So for the Hebrews then, and for us now, we recall Jesus' words. In Matthew 7, 13 through 14. Enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. Am I one of the few? Are you one of the few? Are you sure? Oh God, may you have mercy upon us and help us. Help us, oh Lord. Stand in your word, endure and persevere, especially in times like these days, so that we would be recognized as your true disciples, and that we would know the truth, and the truth would set us free. That we would be your true disciples. We would be part of the few. Shalom.